Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Bob Gwyther.
And Dr. Gwyther is filling in today for Christy Page, who's on vacation. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you.
And on our show today, we're going to be talking with Dr. Thomas Cass, researcher and assistant professor in the Department of Pharmacology at UNC and the winner of a national award, a presidential award for his research. It'll be very exciting. Well, we're going to jump right into the research that matters, and it's great to have you back as a co-host guest on the show, Dr. Gwyther.
Glad to be here.
Bob, you've in partial retirement mode, but you're also working real hard because I see you every day at family practice. What have you been doing, just by the way?
Almost everything I used to do except see patients. So I'm doing some teaching of medical students and faculty, and I'm working with the Center for Alcohol Studies. And I advise a whole lot of medical students.
Well, that's pretty exciting. Well, I know we're going to be talking about a whole bunch of things here on Research That Matters today. We're going to be talking about financial incentives for doctors. We're talking about marriage and colon cancer survival.
Well, this is sort of right up the current alley about we're having so much trouble in healthcare and what's money going to do to it.
Well, let's talk. Yeah, it's very first. Let's just dive right in there. This is a interesting Research That Matters about financial incentives and doctors getting paid. How does that actually work?
Well, there are lots of ways that this can be done. There is a term called paying for performance.
Paying for performance.
Medicare is probably the leader on this, although some of the private healthcare insurance companies and not-for-profits also are doing this. Essentially, what they say is, here's a checklist of things that we would like to have you accomplish with your patients who have fill in the blank. Could be diabetes, could be blood pressure. And if you meet certain percentages
you
of people who have good control, so if your patients are having their, say, hemoglobin A1Cs below 7.
That three-month average for blood glucose control.
Right. Or their blood pressures are consistently running under 130 over 70.
Which is good medicine.
Yes. Then we will pay you more to take care of them. Their reason to do that is to prevent the long-term healthcare costs of the diseases that come from these risk factors, like strokes and heart attacks.
So this is that pay for performance. And here, this research study was where they kind of looked at a whole variety of the literature, of the world's literature that had been done on these sorts of pay for incentive performances, one of these systematic reviews that Christy and I have talked about many times on this show. And this, in Australia, they looked at 7 studies that had done this pay for performance and said, is this a good thing? Does this work? Does it lead to these improvements of healthcare, which is, I guess, the bottom line question?
Right. And the mechanism they're choosing to do is try to change doctor behavior in some way or have them do things per protocol in a way that the paying authorities recognize as better. So, and as you probably are aware as much as I am, you know, changing physician behavior is sort of like herding cats.
We've heard that term, yes.
So what we do to make them change their behaviors? And there's probably some things we can do, and there's a whole lot of things that probably won't work.
Well, in this particular review, it's interesting, Bob, because it looks like that there were certain things, like if they wanted to get the physicians to counsel patients on smoking cessation, that they counseled them more when they got paid more. But it wasn't a dramatic improvement, and it's almost like, well, shouldn't they be doing that anyhow? Isn't that good medicine? So, you know, I was a little ambivalent, frankly, about, and I still am, about this whole pay for performance, because I'm not sure it really works.
So the Hippocratic Oath, which all of us, or many of us anyway, take after we graduate from medical school, says you should do your profession in a proper way, regardless of fees. And certainly advising people to stop smoking is the right thing to do. And so saying, okay, we're going to pay you money if you do more of that, does fly in the face of our ethical obligations as a profession.
Well, this is really interesting. We'll probably have to do a show on this with the guests sometimes. I think there's really complex ethical questions here. There are some physicians who know they're not going to do good on some of these tests, so they just don't play. they don't play to get paid. And that creates then maybe disincentives. So I think we'll have to talk more about this. But let's go on to our very next Research That Matters articles about a research study in the journal Cancer Epidemiology about the relationship between marriage and colon cancer survival. Tell us about, what did you see about this?
Well, Bob? It basically says that married people who are involved in a marriage survive longer than people who aren't. And it's not a
For colon cancer.
And it's not a cause and effect situation. It's a correlation. So the question is, well,
those two things are associated, kind of like the sun is shining and it's cold outside. Those two things are both true, but you wouldn't say those two things were related. Matter of fact, you usually say it's the other way around.
That's correct. So in this case, you could construe a lot of reasons why somebody who's married might get better survival from the end of, well, if they're married, maybe one of the spouses has better insurance. And so a person who's married to somebody else has a higher chance of getting early testing, early discovery, early survival.
Or maybe even better insurance because they maybe have better policies, those who are married, than those who are single.
Also, perhaps people might be more aggressive about treatment because they've got their spouse and who knows else is in the family to live for and continue to provide for and that sort of thing. You can fantasize that as a possible.
Yeah, they looked at 127,000 patient records. And I frankly, Bob, I was a little like, this is what you found? This is what we paid this large research, that if you're married, you had better survival? I probably could have told you that beforehand, that if you have someone who loves you, you probably do better than if you have less people. You know, I don't know. I wasn't overwhelmed by the research. It seems like it's common sense, too.
Yeah, I sort of feel the same. It's certainly not cause and effect, and I think I'm in favor of marriages where a loving relationship exists for most reasons.
Yeah, well, let's move on to our next research that matters. An interesting article. We've gone from cancer. Now we're moving into diabetes, and this was an article in the British Journal of General Practice that says, you know, could we do a better job of detecting diabetes, particularly that which is undiagnosed? People are out there with high blood sugars, and they don't know it.
Yeah, and I think almost any reason that you can safely find somebody's blood sugar and find a high one, you find a diabetic, and then they can start to pay attention to that is a good idea. And here's a captive population, I suppose, if you said that somebody in an optometrist's office was someone who should get their blood pressure checked. You know, there's pharmacies out there now that are offering to do this too.
Right. So this particular research article, they had a 1,000 people in 5 different optometry practices in Durham. No, not Durham, North Carolina, but Durham, England, the other Durham. And you're absolutely right. The question was, could these optometrists feasibly check blood sugars and patients, and would that help get them into care? Which seems kind of like, well, blood sugar is a pretty simple thing to do. You could probably teach our teenagers to do blood sugars on people. It's not a hard thing to do. So it wouldn't be surprising if it couldn't be done.
Right. And, you know, we teach all of our diabetics to be able to use a glucometer and read their blood sugar. And anybody who can use it, alcohol is prep pad properly to keep infection from happening or prevent it as much as you can, could check a blood sugar. And then the question is, okay, so it's elevated. Now what you have is a situation where this needs to be dealt with. And many of the places that get these people got checked, like their optometrist's office or maybe even their pharmacy, aren't about to tell them, here's how we're going to manage your diabetes. That needs to go to one of the primary care providers that would help it for the next step. But as far as diagnosing it, I'd see nothing wrong with it.
Yeah, the only questions I would have is that it does, there are federal standards for laboratories and how you set up laboratories and get quality control, because you don't want to tell someone that their blood sugar is elevated when it's not, or that it's not elevated when it is. In addition to, someone's got to pay for this. And if you come into your eye doctor and they do a blood sugar, are you okay about getting charged, or maybe the insurance companies where it would have to come down? But I agree with you. I think it's a good idea. Probably should look into it. Let's look into our very last research that matters, Bob. And this is a really interesting one that I like. Christy and I have actually talked about it on the show before, about individual research studies looking at the association or correlation, as you would say, between taking some chocolate and having less heart disease.
And this just comes right out and says, if you have chocolate in your diet every day, and a fair amount of it, actually, about 100 grams, I guess, you are less likely to have coronary artery disease. This doesn't count for so-called congestive heart failure, but it does, in their theory, maybe influence the inflammation in the body somewhat by reducing it, and therefore, like aspirin, reduce the danger from coronary artery disease or heart attacks.
Right. And why we picked this particular study is it actually is, again, one of these meta-analyses. They looked at the world's literature, 7 different studies over 100,000 people, and pretty substantive. If I had said we had a new pill out that there's a 37% reduction in heart disease and a 30% reduction in stroke for people who take higher amounts of this pill from the lower amounts, it would really, I think, get doctors interested. Perhaps we poo-poo chocolate too early, and I would hope that there actually could be a randomized controlled trial and really look at this in more detail, because I think this is pretty exciting. And until I hear otherwise, I might start taking a little piece of chocolate every day rather than even an aspirin. I don't know about you, Bob.
Well, it certainly can hurt, I think, unless you're overweight or have diabetes, and then maybe it would.
So we've had a good chance to talk about a piece of chocolate a day for a lot of people. May not be bad.
May not. And I think that's a good thing.
About getting your diabetes checked in the eye doctor.
About surviving from breast cancer if you're in a marriage.
Yeah.
Colon cancer, not breast cancer.
Breast cancer too. And then maybe talk to you with your doctor if they seem to be real aggressive about intervention. See if there's a financial pay for incentive, but it may not even be a bad idea.
That concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking to Dr. Thomas Cash, researcher and assistant professor at the UNC School of Medicine, about alcohol and the anxious mind.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and my co-host today, Dr. Bob Gwyther. We're joined today by Dr. Thomas Cash on Conversations, a researcher and assistant professor in the Department of Pharmacology and the UNC Bowles Center for Alcohol Studies at the UNC School of Medicine. Dr. Cash recently received the Presidential Early Career Award for Scientists and Engineers. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Cash.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And it's really wonderful to have a scientist here talking about what is, I know for both Bob and I, one of the most important issues, health issues, really, in all of medicine, that of alcohol use, abuse. Tell us a little bit about how you became interested in studying alcohol in the mind.
Sure. I mean, I think when you look at science and, you know, biomedical science, people are often drawn towards, you know, problems that they see in their everyday life or problems they've experienced within their family. And I think that's one of the reasons why there's so many people interested in alcohol abuse and alcoholism, is because it's just a hugely pervasive issue. You can't really escape it. And, you know, if you look at the statistics, a lot, you know, almost everyone has a family member or a close friend that's afflicted by this disorder, myself included. I have some of my grandparents who've since passed away had alcohol problems. So to me, it's been kind of a problem that is on the forefront. And so, you know, that's kind of the more social reason. But for me, the more scientific reason is that it's a really complicated disorder. It's not a straightforward, you know, you drink and you feel good about it. It's, you know, there are many facets to it. There's kind of the part where you're drinking and you get drunk and some sort of binge intoxication. There's an enjoyment, but there's this whole other side that is thought to arise and be these more persistent states where people have kind of emotional disturbances such as depression or anxiety. And that's, I mean, kind of the reason it being so complicated really drew me to it as a way, you know, we don't have great ways to treat these various complications that arrive. So it's a perfect opportunity for modern biomedical science, as I see modern neuroscience, to, you know, use all these wonderful tools and skills we have to understand and treat this disorder.
I've always found it really interesting that the place where alcohol is active in the brain, at least one place, is the same place that drugs like Valium or Librium work to lessen anxiety?
Yeah, I mean, it's really, it's one of those interesting things. There's a lot of common ground between those systems. So, I mean, Valium is a benzodiazepine. It acts on GABA A receptors.
Wait a sec. We're going to have to translate that.
I'm sorry. It works.
Even for me, family doc, that you just went way above my head.
Okay. So it acts on, in the brain, we have excitatory systems, which kind of drive firing, drive activity. And then we have inhibitory systems, which tone down activity. And what
things that make me want to do something and things that maybe I shouldn't do.
That's kind of a way of thinking. I mean, you can think about it just as, the output of a certain part of the brain. You know, excitation, excitatory systems will drive it to increase output, and inhibitory systems will depress it and slow it down. So that's what diazepam or Valium does. It acts on those, it enhances those inhibitory systems. So it kind of quiets the system down on the very gross level. I think that's part of the interesting thing about alcohol is that it has many of the same effects in terms of that acute effect that you see. This kind of, when you drink, you experience this reduction of anxiety associated. And it's thought to be involved to kind of the similar enhancement of this inhibitory system. So that has kind of been a starting point for a lot of investigations for the past, I want to say 20 or so years now, this kind of at least 20 or so years, this common mechanism between some of these classical drugs that treat anxiety and the effects of alcohol.
And then the heck of it is that when you take the drugs for a while, it actually affects brain chemistry. Alcohol will do it too. And then if you don't have access to them anymore, everything kind of gets revved up, and it's hard to tell whether it's the absence of the benzodiazepine or a reemergence of an underlying disorder of anxiety.
Yeah, I mean, I think that really is one of the core ideas we have with alcohol research is that, and it's similar with when you use some of these benzodiazepine-type drugs, these anxiety treatments over a long period of time, is when you persistently depress the system or enhance this inhibition within the system, you get this kind of bounce back that occurs, whereas the brain in a sense is used to this inhibition pressing down, and when you remove that source of inhibition, you kind of have this rebound of excitation within the brain, and it is really one of the difficult things. It's a little bit easier for us in animal models of research to tease out, was it there before or after? But when looking at treatment of individuals, it's more difficult to know. You don't have access. You can't do time courses and look, how does this person look when they were 17 years old versus they're 30 years old? And when do these symptoms come out? So it's one of the difficulties with this disorder. It's hard to know what came first sometimes, the chicken or the egg. Was it the anxiety that led to the drinking, or was it the drinking that, this long lasting of drinking that leads to the anxiety when you take away the alcohol?
Well, I know as a scientist, one of the hallmarks is you have hypotheses and then you design experiments to test those hypotheses. Help our listeners and myself understand, what are the types of real hypotheses that you're really testing now in your lab? I mean, you received this presidential award for your research. Less than 100 people in the country. This is very, very prestigious. You must be really working with some hypotheses that are, I think, really, really exciting. Help us understand those.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, really the core hypotheses that I, many of the projects in my lab are centered around have to do with the fact that long-term exposure to alcohol or, in addition to alcohol, long-term exposure or chronic exposure to stressors leads to changes within certain chemicals in certain regions of the brain that, we have these chemicals that are normally, they might be there to, relax you or excite you, depending on how things are going. Whereas after this chronic alcohol exposure or this chronic stress exposure, you have these systems which are normally in check kind of are thrown off. Whereas we have these these protective systems, which are downregulated, we hypothesize. And then we have these, the other side of the coin, these so-called stress systems, which are upregulated.
When you say stress systems, what do you mean?
I mean,
you don't mean like you're running late for work and you have problems at home and that stress that is not necessarily good for people?
Well, I mean, I think stress is a double-edged sword. I think some stress is good, actually. I mean, stress can be really important for focus and motivation. You know, when we think back to when we were all in high school studying for the SATs or the ACTs, you know, stress would allow you to kind of focus and work harder. But it's, you know, an acute stress, okay, is okay, but it's more of this chronic stress, this repeated activation.
Kind of like chronic alcohol.
Yeah, exactly like chronic alcohol. It's kind of chronic engagement of these systems leads to essentially what, you know, the hypothesis we have, it leads to a dysregulation. So things no longer work as intended. And this is where we kind of come into play, where we want to identify these specific changes within the brain and use that as a basis for developing novel ways to treat these different aspects of this disorder.
So if, just before we take a break, help with just one extra step. If these changes of chronic stress you hypothesize are related to the same sorts of things with chronic alcohol use? Or do you think, you think these things, what's the relationship between those two?
I think that there's a tremendous amount of common changes that do occur. I think when you look at the kind of the clinical epidemiological literature, you see that there's a lot of comorbidity between post-traumatic stress disorder, for example, and alcohol abuse, as well as alcohol abuse and depression. So I think that oftentimes these chronic alcohol and chronic stress can manifest themselves in, you know, neurochemically in similar fashions, and that opens the door for kind of treating common symptoms to these disorders.
Thank you. We've been talking with Dr. Thomas Cash about alcohol and the anxious mind.
And we're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue with this conversation. You're listening to Your Health, and we'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Weither today. And we've been talking with Dr. Thomas Cash about alcohol and the anxious mind. And Dr. Cash, right before we broke, you were really helping, I think, our listeners and Bob and I understand better that if there are these common pathways between stressors and chronic stressors and chronic alcohol, that may help us understand those through those mechanisms, better ways of maybe treatment or better ways of diagnosis. What would we find when we find some of these pathways and understand them better? What is your hope that we might find?
I mean, I think the hope is there's many hopes we have. I think one hope is that by identifying these common changes that occur with repeated stress or repeated alcohol exposure is that we can identify new and novel and interesting ways to treat both stress disorders such as PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, or alcohol abuse. That's one of the goals, I think.
And we don't have a lot of treatments, Dr. Guyther. Bob, you're a national expert, and I know in kind of primary care, we don't have a lot of great treatments. We have decent, but not great, right?
Well, pharmacologically, we don't have a lot of great treatments. We got some old stuff like disulfiram, which makes you throw up and be bad.
So you're hoping, Cash, that there's a wide open sea of a potential because there's not a lot there.
Yeah. I mean, the real hope as I see it is, Bob mentioned disulfiram. It's these, you know, this is a drug that it can be very intensely, doesn't feel that great, we might say, but more of a way to, you know, there's never going to be a magic pill that's going to stop behavior such as this. but rather to kind of give people who are seeking treatment the edge to, you know, if one of the biggest problems is if you've been sober for a long time, is something called relapse. And that's when you know, for example, if you get laid off from your job and you're a recovering alcoholic, you know, on your way home from work, maybe that stress will cause you to go back into a bar and, you know, you'll start drinking again. This kind of stress-induced relapse, if we had a way to kind of stack the deck in favor of people who are trying to do the right, you know, trying to stop drinking and keep themselves keep themselves sober. That's really what
kind of like we do with people who are depressed. We have some medications that can help prevent that relapse.
Exactly. I mean, I think it's important to know this is it's a medical disorder, and it should, you know, we should be able to have treatments, or we would like to develop treatments that will target this disorder, with some degree of specificity, meaning that it won't. You know, these treatments won't make people horribly sick. It'll kind of be innocuous other than reducing the risk they have to relapse. So that's one of the goals. I think one of the other goals would be in the course of this work is to help identify different things we call biomarkers in biomedical science. And that's, you know, this can aid us. These are, you know, for example, there might be a protein that's upregulated.
Upregulated meaning?
Increased in alcoholics, for example, or people who have, you know, gone under repeated stress exposure. And the idea would be if we can kind of use that increase in that protein as a test, as a diagnostic marker that can aid, on some level, we'd like to think that can aid primary care physicians. And if we know that certain proteins are increased after chronic stress or alcohol, or if we know that an increase in that protein will make someone more sensitive to some of these behaviors, or they're more likely to develop anxiety disorders after chronic alcohol exposure, the idea would be that we could try and personalize treatment on some level, whereas if protein X is up, we know to be on the watch for, you know, symptom Y, you might say.
You know, right now, it seems like a lot of people who manage to stay sober and stay away from alcohol do that by attending meetings of AA or NA or something like that very frequently. And it has been tried and true that if you grow away from that, the chance to relapse, the frequency of relapse tends to be higher. And I think a curious thing for me is, I mean, something has got to be going on in the brain from sitting in those meetings and listening to other people's stories and telling your own story and benefiting from the wisdom of the people in the room, that ain't where you want to go back.
Yeah.
And it would be really neat to demonstrate that the sobriety part of it was actually accompanied by an explanation physiologically.
I think that would be very, very interesting. I mean, I could make a bunch of educated hypotheses or what we might call guesses as to the reasons why. I think one of the interesting things with the human condition is, you know, we have a very large brain that can, you know, we have this so-called top-down control where we have this really highly developed region of the brain called the prefrontal cortex that really acts to kind of inhibit what you might more base emotional type events. And so it is kind of an interesting idea that maybe going to all of these, maybe going to meetings and seeing this kind of engages this cognitive part of the brain on some level, which helps keep people on the straight and narrow, so to say.
Reduces those chronic stressors, maybe.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, it could be a way. I mean, it's a coping mechanism on some level. Perhaps going there and hearing other people talk about it and hearing these stories is just helping, you know, people realize that they're in control on some level. And I think controllability, you know, being able to control a stressor can be a very important biological phenomenon, you know, in human beings as well as many animal models of research.
Well, speaking of stories, so we're speaking with Dr. Thomas Cash about alcohol and the anxious mind. You just were at the White House this past week or two, receiving your award. Tell us a little bit about going to the White House. It's not every researcher that gets to do this. We all might want to. Were you anxious?
Yeah. No, I mean, I was I was pretty.
You went with your wife?
I went with my wife.
Okay. And, tell us about that.
It was, I went with my, up in D.C., I went with my wife, and my mother actually was in town as well, so it was a nice little trip.
Lots of bonus points.
Yeah, lots of bonus points for bringing your mom to D.C. for a presidential award. But I was very, very, very anxious. You know, it's, like you said, it's not really expected ever that you go to the White House if you win a Nobel Prize, and
the National Basketball Championship.
Or you win the NCAAs. So it was, even though I had already won the award and it was all said, it was very, very, I was really, really high strung and.
Met the president?
Met the president, yeah. There were a couple different ceremonies. One was at the Museum of Natural History at the Smithsonian, where I met Francis Collins and Secretary of Health and Human Services Sebelius. That was really exciting.
Francis Collins is the head of the
Yes, Francis Collins. Yeah, UNC alum, actually, and head of the NIH. So it was really exciting to meet them. And then that afternoon, we went, myself and the other awardees, went to the White House in the East Wing and kind of hung out for a little bit waiting for the president and, 94 scientists. And then we saw Marine One landing. So we all ran to the windows and were kind of gawking at the helicopter, seeing if we can catch a glimpse. And then, the president got off. It was like we were a bunch of teenagers watching the Beatles get off a plane or something. And then, he came in and, spoke to us for about 5 or so minutes. And then, took a photo, the official photo with us, and then, decided he wanted to shake everyone's hand. So it was pretty exciting.
All 90 plus of you.
Yeah, all 90. I think 94. All 94. So
well, that's very exciting.
Yeah, it's pretty thrilling, I think.
I know one thing you mentioned is that doing research is not always glamorous, and you're waiting for results a lot of the time.
Yeah.
I think, we certainly appreciate your willingness to come and share some of your work and insights and passion. I certainly hear, I know Bob does too, this tremendous passion for the work that you do. And I think that it's exciting. It's a great honor for you, for your lab and the university.
Yeah. I mean, thank you very much. It's a great honor. But I think it's kind of a testament to the great environment at UNC and how lucky I've been with having great mentors from, when I was an undergrad doing research up until now, having senior faculty members there to support. And, it's something that I think is incredibly important and that I'm trying to do it on my own as well with my own students and postdocs.
Well, good luck in the future. Maybe you can come back again before your next presidential award.
Sure.
and share some insights again.
And congratulations.
Thank you so much. Oh, excellent. Thank you very much.
We've been talking with Dr. Thomas Cash about alcohol and the anxious mind. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
And we're going to answer a few questions from our listeners right now. We're going to be hearing about patients with diabetes and wanting to stay off insulin. About what else, Bob?
Somebody with pain in their knees that they think maybe got, but they're not sure.
Someone who has a question they're a little embarrassed to ask, but we're glad they're asking it about erections. And
also, somebody who fell, got a pain in their chest, specifically in the rib area, and found out that they had a broken rib, and what should they do?
Okay, well, let's listen to our very first question.
I have diabetes, and my blood sugars have been running high, around 230. I know I'm overweight, but I was on medication that was working well. Why is it not working now? I do not want to go on insulin. Any ideas?
Well, diabetes and high blood sugars, that is a common, common question. Thank you for the question.
Well, diabetes is all about blood sugars and what we can do to reduce them. That's a bit of an oversimplification, but still. And this lady says she would rather not go on insulin, and I think I've heard that hundreds of times.
Yeah, because and there's good reasons not to necessarily go on insulin if you don't have to, because a lot of times it's harder to lose weight when you're on insulin, at least in my experience.
Right. And many people with type 2 or adult onset diabetes have more than enough insulin. It just isn't working well. A few have never had a type 1 complication called ketoacidosis when you're basically running out of insulin. But some people actually don't have the right amount of insulin. And there's a test called the C-peptide that one can do to determine if somebody's really short on insulin. And if they're short on insulin, there probably isn't a way around it. But that's the minority
of
people.
So if this listener checked had a C-peptide checked by their doctor and it's normal, then they don't absolutely need insulin.
Right.
And so the question is, really, what else can they do to stay off insulin? And I mean, certainly this is something that strikes me, and we would know this just right off the bat, easier said than done, but losing weight. And she said that she is overweight. So losing weight would really dramatically lower the chances that she would end up on insulin.
And I think getting a program where they could accomplish that, and there are many of them, but successful weight loss is going to reduce her blood sugar and therefore her need for insulin.
Yeah. And there are also newer medicines out here, but there's a medicine that a lot of my colleagues are prescribing. I don't have as much experience with it recently. Byetta, it's not inexpensive. And there's some older time medicines. We don't know which medicines this particular listener is taking, but there are some older time medicines that are fairly inexpensive and that work pretty well.
And the other thing that she could use is perhaps more exercise, because
Absolutely.
That can also bring blood sugar down without having to go on insulin.
Yep. Great, great, great suggestions there, Bob. Let's go and take a listen to our next listener who's having pains and they're worried about gout.
I have lots of pain in my knees, and my doctor told me I had gout. When I got my blood work, my uric acid was normal. I thought the uric acid was high in gout. What do y'all think?
Well, this is a patient that's got pain in the knees, and there are many kinds of joint derangements that can cause that. Commonly, osteoarthritis is a thing that causes it, especially when it's bilateral. And there are other inflammatory kinds of arthritis, rheumatoid arthritis,
lupus,
various ones that can cause it too. They're less common. So the chance of this being gout is there. The question is, when it's hurting, is it hot and red and just one joint? Because people rarely get two joints
gout
involved
in both joints
at the same
exact
time.
Same time. Yeah, that was a red flag to me. That, and then when you got your blood work back and you said the uric acid was normal, I thought, maybe it's not gout, because that's always a possibility that you got the right diagnosis, which is inflammation in the knee, but the wrong cause. In this case, maybe it's not gout.
Yeah, and well, we got to say this about gout. Gout is a crazy disease, because people can have elevated uric acid or normal uric acid and still have gout, demonstrable by uric acid crystals in their joint fluid. And there are people running around with elevated uric acids that don't get gout. So it's not just a simple thing.
And one of the things that I think we don't do enough when we have a knee that's swollen, we don't like to do it, but sometimes actually taking some of the fluid out in this particular situation and sending that fluid for analysis to see, is this really gout? Because the treatment actually would be different in a lot of circumstances here. And particularly the implications for long-term treatment, putting on people on these anti-gout medicines for life.
Right. And so this needs to be worked up to see what it is causing it. And there's probably treatment for almost anything it could be.
Well, hopefully that's helpful for you. Thank you for your question. And let's listen to our very next question about a sensitive topic, but one that we appreciate getting a question for.
I'm a 52-year-old man that has trouble maintaining an erection. I'm embarrassed to ask this question, but should I take a medicine like Viagra?
Well, that's, a question about erections from a male coming into the examination room. I get this all the time, Bob. I'm sure you do as well. Frequently at the end of the visit, Dr. Goldstein, I just have one more quick thing.
Right. And it's a difficult situation because it's not a simple answer.
What do you mean by that?
Well,
I think that's an important comment. What do you mean?
A lot of people think if they take a Viagra that they're going to have erections without a problem. And it's a much, much more complicated thing than that. In other words, Viagra does not cause them. It makes them last longer and perhaps be more firm, but it does not arouse one to have that. That's another place in the brain.
Yeah, so this complex interplay between the mind and the body and the medical diseases and the side effects of some of the medications you could be on, all of which could be having a factor here.
Right, and there's no magic age. I mean, 52 does not rule out the use of that medication to help, because it works no matter who it's taking in the way that it reduces blood flow out of the erection and therefore has it work longer.
And I think one of the things that's not, and I think just as you said, and what is that this is a longer conversation between the listener and their primary care doctor, because if it's a function of lack of desire or anxiety about performance or other sorts of issues that may or may not be improved with Viagra, and then you're in a situation where you've just given a drug. And this drug has some side effects, not a lot, but some.
And it costs a lot of money.
And it's expensive. Yeah, one of the patients told me recently it was $30 on a pill. I thought, whoa.
I think that depends on who's selling
who's making
it,
the money.
But essentially, it's very – and they're really worried about keeping their patent going. So they're trying to find new indications for it.
Yeah, don't be embarrassed to ask the question. Hopefully our answer begins the conversation. And thank you very much. Let's listen to our very last house call today.
Hi, I fell recently while walking, went to urgent care, and they told me I had broken a rib, and really they couldn't do anything except, you know, take ibuprofen and probably take a couple months to heal. The ibuprofen is not really helping. Do you have any other suggestions?
You know, that's unfortunately a common situation where people fall and they break a rib.
And really, you can't put a cast on the chest like you would a broken arm or a broken ankle. So what has to happen if you have a broken rib is you need to be very careful not to traumatize that area before it's healed, because the thing can actually rip and the jagged edges can collapse a lung. Rather, you need something you need to reduce the possibility of having a fall or an impact in any way that you can. There are some things that you can put on, like just a cloth to tighten it, that seem to comfort some people, but it isn't going to hasten the healing of it.
Yeah, and other than that and time, tincture of time, we like to recommend, you know, ibuprofen is helpful, whether a medicine like a opiate medicine would give you more relief or if you need it or not, but it has some side effects. And then I don't know if you've ever used or heard doctors prescribe, Bob, lidoderm patches, that medicine that's in these patches that just has a local. I don't know if that would help or not, but it might be worth trying.
So there's now a Voltaren cream and lidoderm patches that may help in this case.
Yeah, so maybe a few other things for you to try. Well, we've been able to talk about ribs and maybe a few ideas that if you do have a fractured rib, unfortunately, about what to do, this longer conversation that has to occur with an erection.
And about knee pain, and is it always due to gout?
And losing weight and other ways to understand diabetes. That will conclude our house calls for today. Thank you for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you, and you can share your own questions and stories. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us at online at yourhealthradio.org. Go to twitter.com, and search for Your Health Radio.
We'd like to thank the staff of WCHL, the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest, Dr. Thomas Cash. We hope you'll join us the next time on Your Health.
Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.